Hold on one second.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to the Antique E Show. This is Leslie Gist, your host. Today we have a wonderful guest from Detroit. Her name is Bishop Abby. Bishop Abby is a manager of a wonderful bookstore out of Detroit. And we have Bishop Abby on the line right now. Bishop, would you please introduce yourself and give us your full name, please?
Okay. Good evening. My name is Nkenje Abi. That's my first and last name. I've got a couple of names in between there, but we don't have to go into all of those. I am, as you mentioned, I'm the manager at the Shrine of the Black Madonna Bookstore and Cultural Center. I'm also the artist in residence. I'm the Kwanzaa coordinator. I have a lot of hats that I wear in that institution. But it's, you know, important that we're able to communicate to our community the value of knowing our history. That's what our institution was built to be able to do, is to transmit that information to our community and to the wider world as well.
Okay. When you say your institute, could you just describe your institution? Could you just describe, because we have viewers from all over the country, and many people, you know, may be from places that have never witnessed a bookstore like yours. Give them a synopsis of what your bookstore looks like and what the experience would be for them.
Okay. Well, first of all, our Detroit Shrine of the Black Madonna Cultural Center and Bookstore is not our only institution. We have one in Atlanta, Georgia, and we also have a Shrine of the Black Madonna Bookstore in Houston, Texas. And our store, this June, we celebrated our 39th anniversary. So we've been in business for 39 years. We probably have the largest selection of books written by and about people of African descent. So when you come into our store, we say institution because it's more than just a place where people come and shop. But when people come to us, they are usually quite taken by the large variety of books that we have in every kind of genre, you know, besides fiction, which is the obvious thing that most people are familiar with, but we have history, we have psychology, sociology, all kinds of books that deal with blacks in the military, and just almost every, you know, religion, almost every category of books that you would find in any other bookstore, but these books in particular are written to address our history, our needs, and all of those things. And so that's the first thing that people notice when they come in. And then as they go through our facility, you know, we have a very, very large selection of African artifacts carved on the continent on our main floor as well as in our Karamu Art Gallery that's upstairs. I mean, we sell African clothing. We do weddings. We have a large variety of things that a person can see and experience that have to do with, you know, the culture of our people.
When you say do weddings, what do you mean?
Well, I'm a certified wedding consultant, wedding planner, wedding professional, and I specialize in African-centered nuptials. So sometimes we get couples that are planning on having a wedding or they want a wedding that may have some cultural significance to them. So we are able to order clothing for them, like traditional African clothes. We teach folk how to do their head wraps. I try to put couples in contact with all the vendors that they would need if they were, you know, somebody that can do cakes and jewelry and all those things that that are done a lot of times in the black community as cottage industry, but they can, you know, get those services and be able to make use of people in our own community. And so we've had a few people to get married, actually, in the cultural center,
okay,
in the upstairs gallery. So when I say we do weddings, that means I've worked with, from start to finish, I've worked with couples from the planning stage all the way up to their wedding and also to even style them, you know, like dress their attendants and everything. You know,
perform the fittings.
I perform the fit. I mean, we get the clothes for folks. I perform ceremonies for people. I've written ceremonies for people. If they want something that's different from the usual Western traditional wedding,
So this is like a combination of a Black Barnes & Noble and a Black Macy's.
Well, I'm going to say this. I don't like us to be, you know, I don't think of us as a Black Barnes & Noble or Black Macy's. I think that if anything, because they have very little of what we need in their facilities.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that because of the way we think and why we came into existence in the first place, it's more than just that kind of institution. Because you can buy books in a lot of places, but you can't go into a lot of places and get a true taste or true understanding of who we are as a people. I've gone to other, like I've gone into Macy's, where they call them Macy's, and there's been Marshall Fields and all the different names. But I've gone into those places, and I see the little statues they might have. They don't have anything that's real traditional, but I'll see the African artifacts. And sometimes I ask the folk that work there, I say, oh, what is this right here? And they usually can't tell me anything because they don't really know. Well, it's of our, you know, utmost interest to be able to, you know, to communicate that kind of information to our brothers and sisters, that, okay, we have these things here, not just to sell them to you, but for you to have an appreciation of what we come from.
Okay.
Are you getting my drift?
I'm getting it. And you said a lot in such a short time. I have written down maybe 6 different questions while I'm listening to you.
Oh, wow.
you're really talking. Now, you mentioned 39 years, and at the last remark you made went right back to the 39 years comment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how did your bookstore institution even become in existence?
Okay, well, the founder of our church, the founder of the Shrines of the Black Madonna of the Pan-African Orthodox Christian Church, Bishop Albert B. Clegg, he had an idea that we – see, I'm going to try to explain all these things to you in a short amount of time.
We can always have 2 or 3 shows.
Okay. Well, he recognized that institutions were utilized to enslave us. Okay, the institutions that were controlled by the powers of this country and others were the things that they used to work against us. So, if we wanted to change our own conditions and change our future, we needed to build what we call counterculture institutions. So we have to in this country. You have to go to school. You know, you go to public school or private school, wherever. But the school, the educational system that we're part of, that system doesn't always teach us what we need to know to make a better future for our people. I mean, you know, the rudiments of learning how to read, you know, Africans were taught that after slavery was over with, but just so that we could do the work that somebody else needed for us to do. So reasoning that through is, okay, the elements of education, like Carter G. Woodson said, those, you know, who's the educator, the educated, and the education, who's teaching who to do what. That system is set up to work for those who create the institution. Well, we needed institutions that would serve our interests in our communities, because if you think about it, the only institution that we tend to control in the Black community is the church. That's it. Everything else, the economic institutions, you know, even religious institutions besides the church, those are the ones we control. But the other ones, you know, politics and all those things, we're just trying to navigate our way through those things, but somebody else really controls them. So Jim Mulgee, Reverend Clegg, decided that we needed to have an institution that would teach our people, from the youngest to the oldest, something about who we are as a people, what we come from, our history, and then what we can do to change that. So he charged his sister at the time, 2 of his sisters. They're both elders, all of them. You know, Jim Mulgee, Reverend Clegg was deceased, but his sisters are still living, but they've retired many years ago. But they never knew anything about the business, but he said, okay, we're going to open up a bookstore, a place where Black folk can come and hear Black authors. But we opened in June of 1970, you couldn't go to any mainstream bookstore and hear Nikki Giovanni talk or hear Stokely Carmichael or hear, you know, you couldn't encounter these people in mainstream places because they weren't looked at as important, but they were important to us as a people. So there had to be a place where the voices of Black authors could be heard, where we could learn about our history and have people that staff these places to be able to do that. You know, so we're not just folk that are there as sales clerks or selling stuff, but we're actually there to educate our people and to communicate,
okay,
you know, to our people. And so that was, he had the idea for it. We used to make, you know, oh, God, years ago, you know, you didn't have a lot of import coming in, like African clothes and all that. So we used to, we had a fully equipped sewing room with folks there that would actually make the clothes.
Okay, and you mentioned several different artists. Does your bookstore celebrate all of these artists who first came to the shrine and made the shrine what it is today? Are there pictures? When I ask, what would we expect to see?
Well, we don't have photographs up of the various individuals inside the store. I've been, over the last few years, when we try to have our celebrate our anniversaries, which we'll probably not do a celebration until next year, which will be our 40th anniversary. I had to go through and find our archives, because, you know, when you're living history, you don't think about the fact that you're making history, so you don't always document it. Now I have a lot of photographs of people that we have on disk that we can use and print out as part of what we're, you know, what we're going to display during our anniversary. But back then, back in the 70s, I mean, I remember sitting elbow to elbow with Nikki Giovanni, helping her at a book signing. She was talking, you know, and she was so gracious that after the signing was over with, she personally sent me a note thanking us for letting her be there and all that. I mean, I've sat next to Rosa Parks, Margaret Walker, the late Margaret Walker, and just, I mean, I can't begin to name all the people, but we celebrate them and we appreciate them all the time. You know, we existed because we wanted the community to be able to experience them.
Right.
And you could, I mean, you know, today you can go to mainstream bookstores, and usually it's kind of geared around what they think is going to sell. So they might have a contemporary artist, a contemporary writer that they figure, okay, this person's going to sell a lot of books. But our goal back then was to get the word to the community. And to that end, I think we have done a remarkable job, and people have been so responsive and so supportive over the years.
Okay, I'm going to ask you about how the bookstore expanded, but before you come up with the answer, I want to introduce Dr. Metters. He's from William Patterson University. Are you on the line, Dr. Metters?
Yes, I am.
Okay, would you introduce yourself to Bishop Abbey?
Okay, this is Dr. Metters from William Patterson University. He specializes in slavery and civil rights, American history.
All right, Bishop, could you explain to us how the store expanded in the order of the expansion?
How we expanded. Well, all I can do is say that when we started, we had very little merchandise. You know, we started out trying to find as many of the pertinent kinds of books that we could find that were available and stocking those. We started out with our artifacts, for example. Our upstairs gallery is called the Karamu Art Gallery. And when we started, we may have had just a very few pieces of art. We'd make trips to Senegal and to Ghana and different places and bring back artwork. But as time went on and more people started, you know, embracing this, you know, we'd had Africans that would actually bring things to us that we would, you know, acquire for the store. We've expanded the size of the store over the years. We bought a building that was next door to us and knocked the walls out and kind of expanded in that. But over the years, we've added so many more books available for children and for adults in every genre, every category. So we try to maintain that kind of stock in the store so that, you know, we can, you know, continue with our mission. We also added to all of our cultural centers in Detroit, Atlanta, and Houston. It really started in Atlanta. We have what we call our African Holocaust exhibit. And the sister who was the manager at the time of our Atlanta store, she began to go to some of the estate auctions and things and acquire artifacts that were things that had been used in the period that African people were enslaved in the United States, started buying things, and they put together a real small exhibit in Atlanta, and they didn't have enough room to fit it inside the store, so they had petitioned this mall to let them set up in a room in one of the empty, I guess, vacant stores in the mall, and so they would have everything on exhibit there. And she wrote a real small little booklet about the African Holocaust. And her name is Velma Maia Thomas. And subsequently, after she wrote the little booklet, someone from Crown Publishing saw the little booklet and said, you know, you ought to write a whole book. And so the end result of that was her first book, which is called Lest We Forget, which is an interactive book that has some of the imprints in there of things that we've acquired, like slave bills of sale and different kinds of artifacts, like little pictures of them and our stories. She's written four books altogether.
Can I ask you, Lest We Forget, is that the museum out of Philadelphia?
No.
Okay.
This is a book that she's written.
Okay.
I'm sure that Lest We Forget is a title that may have been used in a number of different capacities. But her book is entitled, the first book she wrote is entitled Lest We Forget. It's a fairly large book and it's interactive. It was written so that young people, youth and educators could actually open this book up and in the front there's a map of Africa. And when you pull the little tab, you can see how Africa looked, you know, centuries prior to the slave trade.
Now,
and then how...
Can someone buy that book online today?
Yes. There should be. I think that we still have some copies of it available through through the Cultural Center, but they can probably buy it on any on-site, online site if they have it. Because
okay.
We actually had, at one point, we tried to acquire the rights to it because it did get published through a major publisher.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't a self-published book. It was from Crown Publishing. But she wrote four books, one following the other, that dealt with our history. No Man Can Hinder Me. I'm trying to think of all of them. I wish I didn't expect to have to talk about them, so I can't remember all of them now. But the books are very good because they follow our history chronologically.
And she was a part of the Atlanta.
She's the archivist now for the Shrines of the Black Madonna for the church, but she's in Atlanta. And she was the Atlanta bookstore manager at that time.
Now, you said that the Atlanta was the first one to have the Holocaust.
The first Holocaust exhibit, right?
Now, which store opened up first? The one in
Detroit.
Atlanta?
No,
okay,
Detroit.
Detroit was the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And how long did it take to open up a second location?
Atlanta. We opened in Detroit in 1970. When we expanded to Atlanta, because every place where we open our churches, we also open our bookstores and cultural centers. So Atlanta opened in 1975. We expanded to Houston in 1978. And when Houston opened, they just had like a little bitty tiny little store because they had to reconvert the building. So the official opening for the Houston store was in 1980.
That was a fast expansion. I really thought you were going to say like within the last 10, 15 years.
No, it was, we were part of our whole thing. We weren't trying to just expand the stores. I mean, we were opening shrines to the Black Madonna churches in those cities. And part of that process is also to have a cultural center.
Now, the Shrine of the Madonna, the Black Madonna,
uh-huh.
Do you want to explain what the Black Madonna means to our listeners?
Well, I think let us work our way back to that a little
okay.
later because that's a much
right.
more involved discussion.
Okay, so we'll have another show on the meaning of the Black Madonna.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have here, we talked earlier this week about collecting antiques.
Mm-hmm.
And today you mentioned that you started collecting, when I say you, I'm talking about the Institute, started collecting artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a difference between an antique or an artifact? Could you explain?
Okay, well, you're talking about the African artifacts that we have in the
right.
stores?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a difference. Artifacts are, and that's the blanket term that's used to discuss carvings and other items that are used in particular cultural functions. So we use the term artifacts instead of just art. A lot of people think when they see African carvings, they just think art, and in their minds they think these things were carved for people to look at, or to put on a wall. But in actuality, which is something I was explaining to our group on Saturday, African artifacts, real African artifacts, were used for a particular function. So you might see a mask, but that mask was part of something that was worn for a ritual, for a particular action that was part of the cultural life of that particular group of people. And so we over the years, we acquire a number of these things from various parts of the continent, from West Africa, Central Africa, East Africa, depending, on what we've, what we found and what we like and what we think our customers would like. We have some things that are part of our collection, which means that we wouldn't sell these things. But then there are others that, if, people want to purchase them, they can.
Now, do you remember the first meeting about taking a trip to Africa for that purpose?
No, I wasn't in the first meeting.
All right.
I have been with the cultural centers as a staff person since like 1977.
Okay.
So the Detroit store opened in 1970. So I was a member of the church since, I've been a member of the Shrine since, 1972. But I wasn't at the very first meeting because I wasn't in the cultural centers at that time.
Now, have you had the luxury and the opportunity to go on any of these trips?
Well, I've gone to Africa, but now when I go on trips, I go for the experience. I don't go to try to bring things over. Because, as I mentioned earlier, the ability to acquire artifacts has gotten a lot easier than it was, 39 years ago. Mm-hmm. That you have a lot of different Africans that come to the United States and they may bring things with them and all of that. But our early trips for our staff members were to actually, go and find things that we wanted to have. I don't think that the trip was just solely for that. The experience of going to Africa, learning about what the continent is like and the people that you're going to encounter, I think that that's the larger piece of it, to speak from that experience.
And how do you share that experience with a person walking through your doors?
Well, I mean, we don't share it with every person, obviously, because everybody's not coming in just to hear that. But when I have opportunities to give presentations, I go into a lot of schools, when we have tour groups, and then just in general conversation, because people do inquire, have you been to Africa, or we'll get into a discussion about something and people say, well, Africans don't like us, and then I have to say, no, that's not true, and this is why I'm saying that that's not true, because we are oftentimes bombarded with propaganda or incorrect information, and so we, kind of walk around with that inside of us until somebody who's had a different experience can share that with us and say, okay, let me share with you what my experience has been.
So are there any photos when you walk into your institution or the institute? Is there any photos, anything? Is it a big map or a globe of Africa? How do I know that when I walk in your store that this is what I'm entering into?
Well,
a place that
the look of our store would kind of let you know that when you come in, because we have masks and other things around in different places. And actually, up until recently, right by the front door when you walk in, one of our vendors, one of the people that we do business with, he put together this poster. And what he had done is called the Cities of Africa. And because in the minds of many of our folk, and, that's from lack of experience, in the minds of many of our people, we think Africa is some big jungle. And we don't recognize that you have major, beautiful cities with high rises and cars and all the things that we have here. So what he did was put together all these photographs of some of the capital cities on the continent and made a poster out of that. And it's inside, it's like the shape of the continent. So when people come in, they can see that. Now, when they go upstairs to the our foyer upstairs, we have a lot of photographs of trips like to Mali and things like that, so people can see those things as well. But I think for the most part, anybody coming in to the Shrines of the Black Madonna Cultural Center kind of knows just from what they see when they, walk in the door, what kind of place that they're in.
Right. Because even though we have access to technology, right now all we have to use to let our listeners understand what they will see is what you're going to tell us. And I think that's a great description of your map. I want to buy it. How do we obtain the cities of Africa, the capital cities of Africa?
Well, we do have a website,
Okay, is that for sale? I don't know if it's on display.
I don't know if well, one thing, because what we have posted on the site are mostly books. Mm-hmm. We do have collectibles, some collectibles on there, and we are working to get artifacts on there, but the artifacts is going to be a little bit more involved because we have to catalog them, take a photograph of the particular piece, and post that to the site. So that's something that we hadn't done in the past, but we've been discussing how we want to do that, and we will be, adding those kinds of things to there. But also, if somebody's interested in something like that, they're hearing this or they're reading our discussion online, they can always contact us, and we can, start the process of helping them get whatever it is they're seeking.
Okay, what is the name of that particular poster you just described?
It's called The Cities of Africa.
Okay.
It's just informational so that people can, and we like to leave it on, we had it on display so that people could, when they walk in the door, when they think about Africa, they can kind of dispel some of the other misinformation that we sometimes get or that we might have. Because sometimes when you watch television, I know I'm kind of going around the block, but sometimes when we watch television and we see, these programs that are asking for humanitarian assistance to the continent, they show these, little villages or communities and kids that are bloated stomachs and starving and flies around their face and everything. And that gives people this idea that that's all Africa is, and I think that that's not a fair assessment of the continent.
Because it's so large.
It's a huge continent,
right.
And, of course, there is poverty.
Like there is
there's
here in the United
huge,
States.
I'm sorry?
Like there is in the United States.
There's poverty in the United States, although I will have to say this. By comparison, and that's one of the benefits of travel, mm-hmm. By comparison, when we talk about poverty, there's a huge difference between those two things. And I'm just now speaking, not just speaking about Africa, but when you go to a number of places, if you go to India, if you go to a number of different countries in other parts of the world, when you see poverty in those places, it's very different than what we recognize as poverty here. And I think that it gives us the idea that there are things that we can do and changes that we can make that can affect the lives of not just us, but people in other parts of the world. And I think that we need, our kids, our children tend to be dismissive of the fact that they can go to school for free, and they don't necessarily take advantage of that. Whereas in many places, in many countries, you can't go to school for free.
Right.
Maybe first and second grade, but after that, your parents have to figure out how to get funds to get you educated. And once we recognize, okay, we have some opportunities we need to take advantage of, not just because for us personally, but so that we can make a difference in the rest of the world. I don't know if I'm making sense to you or not, but, just that experience, just going someplace and, not being able to, let me give you an example. You can go to some places in the world and unless you're in a particular kind of place, you can't wash your hands because there's no sink with running water.
Right.
And so that's, that becomes something that's extremely important. And I think that our children need to recognize that, okay, we have some advantages that we can utilize not just for ourselves, but to bring something better to other places.
Yeah.
Now, I've been in luxury. I've been in great hotels in Africa, very nice. So you've got a big, huge difference between poverty and affluence.
So when you tell the children,
mm-hmm.
about these stories, and I'm going to say this because in my classroom,
mm-hmm.
when I went to Egypt in 94,
mm-hmm.
and I usually don't speak much about myself doing these interviews, but I think it's important so that you understand where I'm coming from.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to Egypt, the first night I arrived, there was a couple from St. Louis, and we had dinner with them, and they gave us a bag of pens. And I said, why are you giving us these bag of pens? And she said, well, when you go to Cairo, you're going to run into some little children, and they're going to ask you, are you American? And you're going to say yes, and they're going to say, do you have pen? And you're going to say yes, and you're going to give them one. So sure enough, we go into Cairo, and the little kid comes up with his mother. His mother pushes him up to our carriage, and he says, are you American? Yes. Do you have pen? Gave him a pen. I got out the carriage, and I took a picture of him holding a pen up. And his mother in the background. And at that time, I wasn't teaching. But it was so profound. So when I started teaching, the students would come up to me and say, I don't have a pen. They didn't bring a pen to school. So when you come to school, you need a pen. And what I did was I blew that picture up, and it's right above my desk.
Mm-hmm.
And if anyone dare ask me for a pen, they have to hear that long story about my Egyptian trip.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand where you're coming from. So I'm asking you, can you tell these students, these youngsters, about appreciating the educational resources they have here? Who do you give credit to for having this system of education?
Well, I don't. Well, first of all, I don't give. I've never even thought about giving credit to anyone about having an educational institution. American education kind of evolved because it needed to evolve in the way that it did. So I don't usually spend time talking about who I give, like giving credit to anyone for that. What I try, my message is that while we can, because the day may come, given the state of things in America, while we can, we should take as much advantage of the things that we have available to us so that we can have them to utilize to make a difference in the world while we can. You see, because it's not guaranteed that 20 or 30 years from now, education will be free in America. You know, the public education, you know, it may disappear. You know, there's a lot of things going on in the United States economically that might preclude a major change in that. But while we have the opportunity to get whatever we can get, instead of wasting time and not excelling, because to excel is important for us. We need to set the bar high and try to achieve as much as possible for us as individuals and for us as a collective group of people. So I don't deal with necessarily how the educational system would give credit to whomever, but I do try to get our young people to understand that they have an opportunity that they need to take as much advantage of as possible. Actually, one of the things that I'm going to do that we plan to do at the bookstore, probably before school starts back, but if not before, soon after, we want to bring as many parents together. I have a lot of parents who've used their, you know, their intelligence to help their children be able to get into college without having, because, you know, we have limited means, so everybody can't afford to pay for their child to go to college. However, if there are things that are going on inside of schools and scholarships that are available, and, you know, you got to work hard and you got to hit the door running. That means when you walk in that door as a freshman or even when you get into the eighth grade, that child needs to start to be working on how am I going to get into a college and how am I going to be able to pay for it. What do I need? You know, what kind of things can I do? And there are, I have a number of people that I've met that are either customers or people who are friends who worked it out, who got their children involved in DAPSEP and all these other programs and got their kids scholarships and funds so they could go to college.
Right.
And a lot of parents on the other side of that, on the flip side of that, I've had people sitting there in my face at the counter who are lamenting over trying to buy a textbook for their child. Textbooks, college textbooks, can cost $50, $100, $200, and their child didn't have any financial resources. And, you know, they're trying to figure out how we can scrape and make this happen because they didn't get things together in terms of getting them some scholarships prior to going to school. So what I want to see happen is as many programs, and there are some. I just was made aware of a new one last week. But there are many programs that can help get our children prepared and get finances, you know, try to, because it's going to get harder, particularly in Michigan. You know, the Chrysler and General Motors have both gone bankrupt, and so, you know, a lot of jobs have vanished, and, you know, folks trying to figure out where they're going to get their, you know, their house from, or their home is going to get foreclosed on. So how are they going to be able to pay for their child to go to college? So there are things out here that we need to begin to try and pull in so that we can at least try to get as many of our young people a higher education as possible. So that's what I'm
saying. Seems like your institution is a very community-oriented organization.
Well, I mean, that's when I started out. I was talking about how that was Reverend Clegg's plan. You know, it wasn't something that, like, we didn't, trust me, when we first opened, money was not something, you know, making money was not something that came very easily, you know, trying to sell things and all that. That wasn't why we came into existence. And right now, you know, we're struggling like everybody else is, particularly in Michigan. Economically, you know, it's not as easy as it was, say, 10 years ago. So, you know, there's a lot of challenges there. However, we have a mission, and we're trying to keep that mission and make that mission, you know.
A priority.
Priority, right. So that's what we're doing.
Now, as far as the Internet, have you been able to supplement the losses that you're experiencing in your geographical location? Have you tried to supplement it by expanding your marketing strategy?
Well,
like in the cyberspace?
Well, what I just – actually, this is interesting that you'd ask me this. I was trying to get some we've been meeting. We've got a group of people that are comprising our advisory board because, as you know, when you run into difficulties, you have to retool and, you know, start to think, okay, what can we do, which is a very good question that you're asking me. What kinds of things can we do to expand our base? Because, obviously, our local base, there's some – challenges there, and so we have a commercial. One of the things that we're trying to upload onto like YouTube and some other venues, so that people can, you know, that they can know that we exist. Besides our website, I think now if you go on and you put in Black Books, I think we come up pretty close to the top.
Okay.
But you know, there's a lot of things that I don't have the expertise in terms of the Internet marketing.
Right.
So that's why we're pulling together other people who have more savvy in that regard, you know, because, you know, I'm an old school person. I can use a computer pretty adeptly now, but it wasn't part of my primary education.
Oh, okay.
You know, I think I saw my first hard copy machine when I was working at Blue Cross, and the computer room was about the size of a football field.
Wow, okay.
You know, I think there might have been, I don't know how old you are, but it might have been prior to your birth, or maybe when you was a little girl. I don't know. You sound fairly young.
I was born in 68. I'm 41.
Okay. And believe it or not, 68 might seem like, you know, that might have been a little while ago, but the computer wasn't in popular use in 68 either.
No, it wasn't. Mm-mm. It wasn't. The computer, I think, can help particularly your business. And you mentioned the students not being able to afford textbooks.
Mm-hmm.
And I took some courses recently, and I purchased my books online, where I use e-books, they call them.
Mm-hmm.
And the e-book is, they allow you to
you download it.
To download it,
mm-hmm,
for only a short period of time, 180 days.
Oh.
It's not your book forever. For 180 days, you only have access to that book. And if it's a subject that I'm really not too keen on and I'm not interested in, then I'll buy the e-book. But if it's something like it was Black history, I would purchase the book and keep it and treasure it.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's a subject that I have to take a core course and I'm really not interested in, I would elect the e-book. So I was going to ask you, when you mentioned helping out the community, have you looked into ways of having these books that they need purchased through the computer, like these e-books, and do you have any technology being used at your facility?
Well, I don't know, and this is something I can, somebody else may have that information, but because these are books that are published by various entities, mm-hmm, I don't think that as a retailer that we have the
rights
to actually to alter the publications or try to put them in that format. I don't know.
No, that's not what I'm asking.
Okay.
They're already in the format.
I don't think all the
you got to ask them. Like, for instance, mm-hmm, many of my old vintage books that I collect,
mm-hmm,
now if you Google, I can probably Google the name of the book that you told us, the lady from Atlanta,
mm-hmm,
Lest We Forget book.
Mm-hmm.
I can more than likely Google her book, and I may be able to see a snippet is what they call it.
Yeah, I understand. Like people go to Amazon and you can see the flip through
right.
the book and look
now,
through that.
If you pay for it, they'll let you see their whole book. And that's up to the author and the publisher.
Right.
So right now there is a battle going on between Google and a lot of big publishing companies, because Google is going online and downloading, this is what a lot of publishers are accusing them of doing, downloading books without getting permission.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, that's one way you can help preserve your institution and also help your community, especially the students who can't afford to purchase a book. And if they're computer savvy, like many of our students are today, I think they would prefer and feel comfortable using these e-books. They don't have to carry them. Students don't like to carry books, especially in Detroit. It's cold, you know.
Well, once again, I can't, you know, I can't answer that in that manner, because I think it does have something to do with who owns the rights to the books, and
okay.
whether I don't think we would be the entity that would be able just to do that.
Okay.
As a
well,
retailer,
that's something you could look into when we get off the phone, or ask some of your people, your staff, they could look into partnering with e-books that are already in existence that you have on your shelf in textbooks. I know it helped me out personally, and that's just something I wanted to put out there to you, because I support what you're doing. Now, many years ago, my husband and I went to a
African World Festival.
Right.
Takes place the third weekend in August.
Right.
Here in Detroit every year.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at several pieces that I bought from them right now. And that had to be, I probably went there in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even think it was 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And how are you collaborating with them? And did you help bring, did you know, did the Shrine help formulate that World Festival? Or was it already in existence prior to?
The African World Festival is a separate kind of, in Detroit, every summer, each week, there's been a different festival. They have the Arab American Festival, Ribs and Soul, which is like, you know, the black but not African festival. There's a Mexican, you know, Mexican festival. Different organizations or different groups of people in the city kind of came up with this format. I know when I first came to Detroit, they had already started doing this, and I think the African World Festival has grown in size and in sheer desire for people to come from other places. Here in Detroit, the Museum of African American History is the organization that kind of is the front, you know, the organizers for that particular festival.
Right.
In the past, I have worked with the museum. I've worked with other entities that were doing, like, I'm past president of the Detroit Association of Black Storytellers. So we had the Children's Pavilion where we would do stories. I would meet with people from the museum and suggest ideas to them about what they could do as far as activities for the children. But it's their baby. You know, I've done fashion shows with them for the main stage, you know, African fashion shows, that kind of thing. But it's a huge undertaking, and it's something that, you know, the museum also uses that as their fundraiser, because they, you know, they sell the booths to the various vendors that come in. Most of the vendors at the African World Festival are vendors from out of the states.
Other country?
Well, some of them are from out of the country. Well, you got a lot of Africans. They live in other cities. They don't come all the way from Africa to have a booth at the African World Festival. That's a bit expensive. But a lot of the African vendors, they might live in New York or another state, and, you know, they work together to acquire the different booths, and they set up, you know, down there. And it's quite arduous. You know, I've participated on a couple of different levels. I've never been a vendor down there, but that's because that is just – I'd rather go and enjoy myself and go to the festival and you know, meet people or do something that I feel comfortable doing. And it's a huge, huge
undertaking. I had a ball.
Great.
I enjoyed myself immensely, and I can't wait to go back. Now, what day does it take place?
It's always the third weekend in August. I don't have a calendar in front of me, but they're standardized to be the third weekend in August. I had a booklet, but I don't have it anywhere near where I am that has the dates and all the different activities for the festival. You know, we try to make sure people get that in their hand, so we have the stuff in the bookstore. So when people, you know, are coming through and they want to know about the African World Festival and the Concert of Colors and all those things, we have those things in the store for people to pick up. And pretty much like flyers and tickets for a lot of the events, we'll sell the tickets for people, for the, you know, people putting on the events, so that, you know, people can, you know, have access to that.
Right.
But is this, so if when we talk later, if we talk later, I can give you the dates, but I know it's the third weekend in August.
Okay. Well, I'm happy that you're a part of the festival, and you said it has been going on since the 70s.
Oh yeah, those festivals on the water, on the riverfront of Detroit, they've been doing them for years. Seems like I remember when I first used to come to visit Detroit was like I said, in like 70, 72, when I first used to come up here, they had it at the fairgrounds, which is, it's like near 8 Mile Road, but that's not big enough. It was not big enough to hold those festivals, and so they moved downtown. I cannot tell you what year they moved downtown, but I know that they moved them down to the riverfront, which is real nice. You've been here, so you know what I'm talking about.
Right.
The Hart
right.
Plaza, and it's really nice, and the experience for somebody that's coming from someplace else, and it's the thing that they see when they get to Detroit. I think it's quite impressive.
It is. It's very impressive, and I was stoked. I'm not good with geography. I was
mm-hmm.
so upset that it was that close to Canada, and that seemed a tunnel to Canada.
Yeah.
I was so upset. I said, you know, I would have extended the vacation and went over to Canada.
If you had known you were that close
right.
to Canada.
And I had to go home too early. I was like, wow.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to make a trip.
You got to study Detroit, study place before you go. A little bit more before you get out and make your plan.
That is so true. Now, when I mentioned Canada,
mm-hmm.
Do you have a relationship with Canada? And what is your experience with Canada and the store's relationship with Canada?
Well, we get a few Canadian groups that come through. We've done a couple of events there. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but there's like Underground Railroad tours and things like that. And we work with a sister who she does this bus group. And what happens is they go to several sites in Detroit, like the Second Baptist Church, First Congregational. These are like underground railroad historic sites in Detroit. They might go to the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History. They'll come to us because we're going to do the African Holocaust pieces for them, and then we continue on to the border, you know, to the water, to the river.
Right.
And they actually go across into Canada, and then they have reenactments of people coming across the Detroit River in small boats. People who, you know, were escaping, because Detroit was the last stop on this side of the river for people who were escaping enslavement. And then they would go across to Canada. On the other side in Canada, right across the bridge, you go to Puce, and we've done a couple things there at the John Freeman Walls Historic Site in Puce.
Okay.
Also in Canada, you got Amherstburg and a number of other places where there are either museums or historical sites that African people, you know, have been to. But it's real. We've done a few things with them, but
Is that an annual event? Would
it
be a reenactment?
It was intended to be an annual event. They ran into some difficulties the second year that we tried to do it with regard to finances. So we're open to, you know, the next time they want to put it together, we're going to try to start working on it much earlier so that the finances are, you know, can be made available. That, because all those things cost money when you're trying to put bus groups together. You know, you got to feed people. You got to, you know, plan out this reenactment. Now, the Canadian side of it, I think they do that every year, but they don't always have a Detroit contingent.
Okay.
So that's what we were trying to bridge, was Detroit and Canada.
Now, how much of your business is from tourists?
Not a large portion of it. Not of late. We have, you know, we, like we said, we if you go on our website, you know that we let people know that we do actually do group tours. We offer lectures, storytelling, depending on what the group wants and the age group of the tour, because sometimes we have tours with senior citizens, sometimes they're, you know, they're children, teenagers. It depends on the group. We've had groups of educators that come yearly from California, and we're part of the Metro Detroit Convention and Visitors Bureau, and we're trying to, you know, as groups come to Detroit, you know, they do send them toward us so that we can try to book them for a tour, you know, that, you know, when they come to Detroit, if they're coming to try and absorb some of the culture. A lot of times groups of people, a lot of family reunions and groups come, but they're more interested in going to casinos and doing, you know, the recreational things.
Right.
So our hope, and we started on this, that not just us, but a number of the other entities in Detroit, the museum, you know, we meet together from time to time. We've been trying to develop ways to put information, package it, so that groups of people coming from other places to say, okay, we want to enrich our experience by visiting these kinds of places.
Well, how many other black institutions similar to yours exist in Detroit? How many do you think?
Well, they're not the same as we are, but they all are part of things that people would want to embrace. You have the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History.
Right.
There's First Congregational Church, which is a historic site in and of itself, and they actually have an Underground Railroad experience that they take you through. There's the Second Baptist Church. There is Detroit Historical Museum. There's several places in the city, and I'm not naming all of them right now. I didn't expect to have to try to name them all, but I know that we've met together from time to time, and we, you know, the person that's in charge of Detroit Michigan Council of the Arts, Brother Oliver Ragsdale, we were meeting with him and with different galleries. You know, we're trying to formulate a package so that people can know, okay, these are the places that are available in Detroit if you want to have a culturally enriched experience.
Right.
These are the places that you want to go to.
Huh? Especially those family reunions.
Yeah, that would be what I would want folk to do. Now, you know, people have different ideas about what they want to do when they come to a city. Mm-hmm. And given some of the problems that Detroit is having, Detroit needs to. This is just my humble opinion. Mm-hmm. We might need to come up with some things to draw people into the city.
You know, may have to invest in a little shuttle bus.
Well, that's not a difficult thing, mm-hmm. but getting the people to the city itself. Because
well,
we can always
you don't
put together.
Come, you trying to say they don't want to come to the
I
city?
I think that Detroit of late has been getting some bad press. More bad press than it has in the past, and I think that's something. You know, if you're trying to, because the automobile. Let me just say this, and because this really isn't necessarily my area of expertise, but I'm gonna speak about it because I live here now. Detroit is a one industry city, the automobile industry, and because that is crumbling, there's a need to develop other things that can bring people into the city of Detroit where they might be able to spread some capital around but also have a good experience. And I think that it behooves Detroit and Detroiters and institutions like ours and others in Detroit to try and find ways to expand people's experience and get people the desire to come here so that we can have, you know, I don't know, have you been to Orlando, Florida?
No. Oh, yes, I have. Yes, I have.
With Disney World and
yes,
all these other, the Universal
Epcot.
Studios and all that stuff.
Right.
Orlando, as a city, is primarily a city that people go to for entertainment and tourism. They don't have, like, a one industry kind of thing there except for tourism. So that means they have a preponderance of hotels, they have restaurants, they have things that people, when they're going on vacation, they go to Orlando for their vacation. And that's what Orlando's kind of built on, where here in Detroit, we built on the automobile industry, which is now kind of hitting the skids. So as a city, we're going to have to start to retool
now,
in terms of thinking about some other ways of drawing people in. And Detroit has a rich cultural heritage, particularly when we're talking about the Underground Railroad. And anybody that's black might want to understand more about that. So that might be something that we need to look at.
Because
we've got Motown. The Motown is here. I don't necessarily frequent the Henry Ford, but they've got a lot of historic things at the Henry Ford Museum. You know, they even have a little Motown thing there. Huh?
You have subways.
No, Detroit does not have mass transit other than buses. This was an automobile city.
Okay.
There was very little desire on the part of the automobile industry to have rapid transit in Detroit. You know, it's something that's been batting around for the last few years. But now it might become something that people recognize is going to have to happen. But there's no money to actually create it right now. But that was one of the reasons why Detroit. I'm from Chicago originally. Chicago has great public transportation, rapid transit and all that, but not Detroit. Because they wanted people in Detroit to do what? Buy cars.
Got you. Now, you mentioned the Underground Railroad several times.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I told you. I wrote a book on the Underground Railroad.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and Dr. Metters, who is online, he also wrote a book on the Underground Railroad. This show evolved from the book and us wanting to talk and share more about the Underground Railroad.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know much about what happened in Detroit with the Underground Railroad. My stories are based in Philadelphia and in New Jersey. And Dr. Metters, you speak for yourself. Stop being shy.
For me? No, I'm listening to her. I'm just getting great insight. That's right. Yeah, we got to just do another show. She's got a lot of great insights into the nature of the cities and how they differ. That's a big issue. And just, you know, these one town cities with these one industries and Detroit basically is has gotten bad press. I've been trying to read about the mayor. I think it was Kilpatrick, and then we had Bing and things like that. I'm trying to figure out, you know, who they are, what they're about, and what they're trying to do to the city and things like that, because that's something that nobody really has a real insight. You know, I haven't got a good insight of it. All I've gotten is about, you know, Kilpatrick and his wife and his mistress and Bing, the basketball player, and things like that.
So is that what
you said,
Abby?
I don't know what that.
What you're alluding to when you said,
I mean, that's not the only thing.
Press?
Well, that
might be, you know, high crime and stuff like that they had. I know what she's trying to say.
Okay, I didn't know. I didn't put that together. I remember that story, but I didn't associate it.
Well, that's the white press, and the white press is kicking that out a lot. You know, every time we turn around, we talk about the crime rate.
Dr. Metters, I expected you to explain to her about the Underground Railroad in your book. That's why we were talking about the Underground Railroad.
Okay, well, anyway, we're going so far afield and so broad, but you know, the book will be coming out, I guess, in November by Africana Press, and so, you know, it's called Kidnappers in Philadelphia, and it's about...
Say that again, you spoke so quickly, I didn't hear.
I talked New York fast. Kidnappers in Philadelphia.
Kidnappers in Philadelphia?
Yeah, that's the name of the book. It's called Kidnappers in Philadelphia, and it comes out in November.
What is the book about, Dr. Metters?
It's basically about a Quaker named Isaac Hopper and abolitionists and what their role was in helping blacks escape. And then they were one of the first people to basically interview blacks and get blacks to talk about their experiences when they lived in the South and how they made it up to, you know, Philadelphia and how they're trying to survive and how to stay one step ahead of the kidnappers who were from the South in Maryland and Virginia and South Carolina coming to Philadelphia trying to re-enslave them and bring them back.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just right after 1790s and 1800s, right after the war, because Hopper, he was born just before the Revolutionary War. And we don't have that much. It took a while, I think early on in the 1800s, because blacks were able to have what we call their own testimonies, which what they went about. Usually the white historians, and they monopolized the field, and they would draw on the planters' accounts about what happened to blacks. And naturally, we never got a really good insight of what really happened, because the planters would always say, if you apologize for it, or say that, you know, that the nature of us is to be slaves, things like that. That includes George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and Patrick Henry and James Madison, all of them. They left, writings, and they did talk about slavery and enslaved blacks, but it never rose from the eyes of what blacks who were the victims of those type of planters or slaveholders, what they had to say. So Hopper, basically, he interviewed blacks, Isaac Hopper, who's the main Quaker I'm talking about, Isaac Hopper, and whatever, he interviewed
them. White abolitionist?
Yeah, white Quaker abolitionist.
Yeah.
So very radical on for a Quaker. Even the Quakers threw him out in New York City. And the first person that Frederick Douglass met when he went to New York City when he escaped was Isaac Hopper. And Isaac Hopper was helped with other black abolitionists help find a place for him to stay and get him out of New York because there were so many people there who would just turn him in probably and present him back down south that it was too dangerous for him. And that's one of the people that he met. But the thing is that I was just interested in finding documents that draw on the accounts of blacks themselves to tell exactly what happened to them. And then the mainstream white historians, they never really picked up on black accounts because they said it was too biased by abolitionists, you know, or they were too, you know, they were not objective enough.
Dr. Mutter.
Yeah.
I just want to ask you a question. I'm sorry to, you know, if I cut off
yeah.
your train of thought. But I don't know, are you aware of the add-ons that are in the Library of Congress of
yes.
that were done in the 20s, in the 1920s?
They
had a lot of young.
WP, you do about during the, okay, I'm sorry, okay, finish your thought, I'm sorry.
That during the 1920s, that a number of people were sent out, that most of the people that took the accounts were white, but I didn't even know this until a few years ago, that in the early 20s, there were still like 100,000 people that were still alive who had been born in slavery, and
yeah,
they
yeah.
actually sent folk out to go and get their accounts of what their experience was
yeah,
as enslaved people. And
yes,
there's a book that we have. It was a real smart move on the part of HBO to do this, but they took some of those accounts, and it's in a book called Unchained Memories.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with that book?
It's a DVD. It's
also a book.
A DVD.
Well, they had a few of them that different black actors like Samuel L. Jackson
yeah,
and his wife and others read those some of
right.
those accounts, but they didn't
yeah.
do that whole book. But that's
right.
that book is just a fraction of the ones that are in the Library of Congress, these accounts. And it was initially very difficult, probably all the way through, it was difficult for them to get people to be willing to open up because they were talking to white people and these people had been enslaved. So
right.
they weren't real anxious to tell their story to, you know, some white folks that they didn't know if they could trust them or not. But
right.
there are quite a number of accounts. And I don't know if the Library of Congress is ever going to, you know, I know you can probably get to them, but there's been a few Bullwhip Days and a few other books that have come out that have those individual accounts that
yes,
people
yes, you're
have,
right.
have and some of them are real short and some of them are really long because a lot of people were children or they were relatively young. But
yes.
by in the 1920s, it was that many people still alive that had been born enslaved. And I was like, wow, that's just a tremendous thing. So I didn't know if you were aware of that, because
yeah.
that might be something you might want to delve into a little bit more.
Right.
Well, he was in Columbia.
Did you ever hear? Huh? Did you ever hear? Oh, sorry, one second. Did you ever hear of John Blasingame of this book called Slave Testimony?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He's the one that basically, well, he's my mentor. He's my dissertation advisor. And he's the one that he's talking about the Work Progress Administration that was done during the Depression, and they sent a lot of people down south to interview the blacks that were still living.
Mm-hmm.
Are you aware of that? Are that's what you're
I
talking
think
about,
it's the
too?
Same story.
Yeah.
I think we're talking,
right.
I think we're probably talking about the, you know, I know they started in the 20s, but they might have been doing it for a while.
Yeah,
30, I think we're really kind of talking about the same thing.
Yeah, Work Progress Administration. And a good point, yeah. Leslie, you're going to say something? I don't want to cut you off. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I just thought it was amazing that Bishop Abbey is really interested in the Underground Railroad as a means of helping bring business to the Shrine Institute. And
I'm talking about more about the city of Detroit.
Yeah, and
it's
connected
yeah.
with the Underground Railroad. And being so close to Canada, I think that's very logical, and I think I don't see how you could not succeed with focusing on the Underground Railroad. Now, you talked about Isaac Hopper, a white abolitionist. My book is about a black abolitionist. When we first met, I didn't know that Isaac was white, Dr. Meadows. I thought he was black. But my abolitionist was Mr. William Steele. He helped Harriet Tubman throughout her journeys. And every time she would bring someone through Philadelphia, he would write down a narrative from the newly freed black individual so as to help them reconnect with their loved ones, even if they were already freed or if they anticipated that they would come behind them. So at the end of the Civil War, he took all of their narratives, and the book is 800 pages. He put all their stories in one book. And the book is entitled The Underground Railroad. And he sold his book. He self-published it, and he sold it in places like your bookstore. And I just want to give you that tidbit of information because you're speaking to two people who are highly involved with the Underground Railroad. I researched my book over 10 years. Dr. Meadows has been working with his Underground Railroad book for how long, Dr. Meadows?
Many years, and I'm interested in Detroit too as well. You know, the strange thing about this history, I think, you know, somebody has the time and energy because it's a specialization in and of itself. You know, you have to have somebody say, okay, this is what you're going to do for the next 2 years. You're going to go to Detroit, and you're going to dig up all this different things that you're about the Underground Railroad, and then you're going to write about it. And then, you know, we look at it, we proofread it, we look at it again, and then we put it out there. But somebody, I got to go look, and I'm going to look to see if anybody did anything on the Underground Railroad in Detroit. Have you done look at the bibliographies and see if anybody put something out there? It's strange that nobody would talk about the Detroit Underground Railroad.
Well, about 4 years ago here in Detroit, and I don't think anything was published from this particular event. But 4 years ago here in Detroit, we had the Underground Railroad Symposium, and it was held at First Congregational Church. That's a place I told you was one of the historic sites. And there were people from all across the country who were archivists and people that were involved in Underground Railroad dissemination, information, research, documentation, all of that. And I wish, and I haven't spoken with Reverend Lottie, who is the person that called the symposium together. I haven't spoken with her in quite some time to find out if any of the materials and things that they brought with them were actually kind of bound and published, because that was the centerpiece. We had people from Canada, you know, besides Amherstburg, there's a whole community in Canada, because one of the things that people may not be aware of is that after slavery was officially ended in the United States, a lot of people who had escaped to Canada decided to come back to the United States because they wanted to find their family members. But a lot of the ones that stayed in Canada moved in, they built up this community called Buxton in Canada. So we've had people that came from the Buxton settlement, people that were from Ohio and all these various different states. It might have been some people from Philadelphia as well, but I can't remember now. It's been a while. But it was a whole host of folk that we had like a four-day symposium to, you know, they had papers that they presented and all that. But I just wanted to go for the experience of encountering all these people and to get a chance to. There's an organization called the Fred G. Hart. It's Genealogical Society. They were there because a lot of people have been trying to trace genealogy, and that's one of the difficult things, depending on how the families were moved around or if records were kept. They were there. It was really a great number of people that came together with a lot of information.
Great. That sounds exciting. I hope that they're going to have another meeting, because I'm pretty sure Dr. Meadows would like to go. I would like to go. And we had two other guests on previous shows just recently that were Underground Railroad Museum curators in Philadelphia. And we had another person that was involved in Underground Railroad. So we want to stay in touch with you.
Okay.
And find out more about what's going on in Detroit around the Underground Railroad, and see if we could make some connection somehow, because there's something happening here. I think that you're mentioning Underground Railroad as many times as you did is a signal that we need to get on board and work together with each other. No pun intended.
What we can do, and we'll have to do this maybe, you know, like a week or so from now after we get through this particular interview. I'm going to try to make sure I get Reverend Lottie's contact information. She's the pastor at First Congregational, and that's where they actually convene the symposium. If I can get you her information, and that's where they actually do, you know, these enactments, and it's really quite interesting and enjoyable experience, because you get a certain kind of feel. It's like you feel like you're outside in the dark, going from place to place. I'm serious. I was quite impressed with the whole thing, but I'm going to try to get you her information, because she was the one, like I said, she was the one that convened it, mm-hmm. and I think that she would have a lot of those contacts, and they may actually have put. I got a big notebook full of information, but I haven't had a chance to ever sort through all of that. But I don't think there was a book that was published like that. They sent us our stuff after the symposium, and on the last day, a very close friend of mine passed away. So it kind of took me out of the whole experience at that point. But I have all the materials, and I'm going to go through those as well, because I might have some contact information or other things that I can share with you.
Oh, that sounds great. Now, you mentioned Canada, and I'm looking at a website, Emancipation Day Celebration. Are you familiar with
that? I think that is exactly what I was talking about earlier,
mm-hmm.
that we were trying to work with them, because they actually try to work through this. I think we're talking about the same thing, but I don't have that in front of me, so I can't be certain.
Okay.
What's the date on that?
This is July 31st to August 3rd, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to try to make this event this year. And I'm trying to coincide while you're talking. I was trying to get these dates together. Now, you said the World African Fest.
It's the third weekend in August.
The third.
So it's going to be after that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's going to be 2 weeks after that. It's not at the same time.
All right. Okay. Well, it seems as though there's a lot going on in your vicinity, and I was thinking about Malcolm X. Isn't he from Detroit?
He wasn't born in Detroit. He lived in Detroit. He did actually. I don't think he actually lived in Detroit. As I go back and read the stuff about him, they said he lived in Lansing for a while, but they called him Detroit Red. But I don't know if he actually lived in Detroit proper. Betty Shabazz is from Detroit.
Okay.
His wife was from Detroit, but I don't know in Malcolm's history. When I go back and read the books, I don't know if he actually lived in Detroit.
Okay.
As a resident of the city,
okay.
But he wasn't from Detroit. Initially, he wasn't born in Detroit.
Now, people like myself who want to visit Detroit, and you're
mm-hmm.
saying that we would. Right now, you guys are trying to put a pamphlet together to tell us where the cultural events are in places.
That's what we had been meeting to do. The process for all of this, and I'm just going to be really honest with you, because you're working with a lot of different people, different organizations, and, you know, you get started on something and they, you know, say, well, I don't know. And, you know, everybody's struggling to take care of some of the other business things. And I need to get back with Oliver Ragsdale from the Council of the Arts and see if we can actually do this, because all of it costs money. In the Conventionist Bureau, at one point we did have that done. We had a booklet. Follow the North Star was what it was called, and that was actually published and put together. I might still have a couple of copies of that, but unfortunately, a lot of the listings that were in there when that was published, we have a rapid turnover of businesses in the Black community, as you might be aware.
Mm-hmm.
And so, what was in existence at the time that last booklet was published,
mm-hmm.
they may not all be still in business. So that's something that has to be, you know, updated. And it was a really nice booklet. It was all in color and all the listings and everything. But we were talking about trying to do one as an entity, you know, us various different Black organizations. Because the Conventioners Bureau is a big organization that you join and you pay dues to. But we don't run it.
I got you.
I was going to ask you a question about Rosa Parks. You said you met her and she lived there and everything like that. And you know, was you? You only been in Detroit in 4 years, for the last 4 years, I assume. Right?
No, who me?
40.
Yeah. Oh, you've been here for the last 40 years in Detroit.
I've been in Detroit since. No, I haven't been here 40 years. I've been in Detroit. I came to Detroit. I officially moved all my stuff in 1974. Then I left Detroit in 1977. I lived in Kalamazoo for a number of years, and then I came back to Detroit in 1986. But I left Chicago in 1974. I left Chicago to come to Detroit. But what was your question that you?
Oh yeah, I was going to ask you a question about Rosa Parks. You said you sat right next to her.
Yes, sir.
What year was that?
Oh my God. I think because it was a book that was written about her. And if I remember correctly, it had to be somewhere around 92.
Guy named Brinkley wrote the book?
Huh?
Guy named Brinkley wrote it?
No, not that one. There have been several books written about Rosa Parks.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, it's been such a long time that I can't even recall which one.
Yeah, I know. Don't worry about it.
Was.
But Sonia Sorrow, I mean, what was, you know, what happened? I mean, what was you sitting next to? Did you have a chance to talk to her?
Yes, well, see, when we do events, like when we have, you know, individuals that come to, because she wasn't the author of the book, but she was there, and everybody wanted to meet her, and they wanted her to sign, and I just liked the idea of sitting next to Rosa Parks, and she was a very soft-spoken, very gentle-spirited woman.
Right.
And she was very, you know, very elderly as well at the time.
Right.
And it was just the idea that I'm sitting next to Rosa Parks, Mother Rosa Parks. In fact, we did a couple of things. There's institute that's named for her, and it was established while she was still living. And so as part of the fundraising effort for that institute, we put on a fashion show for the Rosa Parks Institute. They sold tickets. We did the fashion show at one of the at McGregor Library, which is now unfortunately closed. That was in Highland Park. But, we just wanted to try and, you know, do as much as we could to let her know that she was appreciated.
Right.
Yeah,
did you interview her?
No, I didn't interview her. I never, you know what, I have talked and met a whole bunch of folks, and I never do what you call an interview.
Right.
I don't do that. I've got photographs of myself with people like Sinbad and Gladys Knight and Susan Taylor, and you know, because I've met some of everybody over the years that's either written a book or been involved in a book that was written about them. I had the pleasure of being with Ruby Dee, and this was not long after Ossie passed away, and you know, she and Ossie had written a book together, and so one of the sorority organizations in Detroit had wanted her to come in as a speaker, so they asked us if we would come and do the books at the hotel. And so I said, sure, I'll come there and sell books with Ruby Dee. And I was, you know, I was right there with Ruby Dee, and I got a chance to talk with her a little bit. But I had met her before when we gave her and Ossie the Zora Neale Hurston Award at the Storytellers Convention in Orlando. You know, so, I mean, that's just, I never interview people. I just want to get to know them, and we talk and just have that shared experience. I've never even thought about, and you know what, you bring something to my mind and says, well, maybe I could at least jot down some of what you know, what we talked about or my experience with that person, because that's, as I look back over my experiences being in the cultural center, that's a lot of people.
It sure is.
Yeah.
Dick Gregory, I mean, all kind of people. And I, you know, I just like the idea of having met them and had a chance to talk to them and say, in my lifetime, these are people that I've met. But I never once thought about how I can, you know, put that down on anything and, you know, put it together in something, but I might need to do that.
I think you do.
I
also have another person online who would like to introduce himself to you. Are you there, Mr. Jerry Butler?
Yes, I am. How are you all?
Thank you for being patient, Dr. Jerry,
well, you know,
Jerry Butler. I know another person named Jerry Butler from my own.
And look, I'm not that Jerry Butler, but I do.
That for a long time.
But you know, but I do sing. But don't get me started. And I just wanted to say welcome to everyone, and also the home, the birthplace of Malcolm X is Omaha, Nebraska. And if you think back, Leslie, you remember we had Dr. Myers. Remember he was on too and was going to that jazz procession that was in Omaha when you were doing his interview.
About
and he was
Jane
telling
Jane.
Us that right. that was the home of Malcolm. You remember that now?
I remember it. I'm not trying to educate. I was just trying to make Bishop feel comfortable and, you know.
Now, I understand. But, you know, but now he does have a Michigan link now because the family did move to Lansing, Michigan.
That's what I said, Lansing.
Yeah, and in 1929, the house got burned down, you know, after they got there. And in 1931, the father, Earl, got murdered. And the mother went on to have a nervous breakdown, and the 8 children got sent to various foster homes.
Mm-hmm. That I know.
That's right. Now, as far as the Underground Railroad, Detroit does have a historical museum that also talks about it. And one such place that they talk about was the Finney Barn that was located in Capitol Park at Griswold and State Streets. Is that ring a bell? Seymour Finney, you know, an active abolitionist, owned both the Finney Hotel and the barn.
I think they have a plaque down there in that area, but none of those buildings were preserved down there.
Wow.
That building wasn't preserved.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure there's a historic plaque. You know how they do those green things and they have them on a stand?
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's down there, but I'm almost absolutely certain. That Griswold, I know that it's not still down there.
Right, and Seymour Finney was an active abolitionist. He owned both the Finney Hotel and the barn, and it said that white slave catchers spent the night at the hotel, and the fugitives were being safely hidden in the Finney barn. And you know, you also have another historic site where Michigan's first Masonic Hall was built in 1851-52 along West Jefferson Avenue. And this site served as a station in Detroit's Underground Railroad, both before and after the building was completed.
Go ahead, Jerry Butler. I didn't know you were about
Underground Railroad. Where should we buy
on top of the case. Well, you know, I just try to bring a little something to the table, you know, that's all, because Detroit was one of the largest terminals of the Underground Railroad and a network of black and white abolitionists aiding enslaved people seeking freedom. And more than 45,000 fugitive slaves made their way to freedom through Detroit and
mm-hmm.
Windsor on the Underground Railroad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a major stop. And actually, it was another caller call in or something talking about the, what were they talking about, the memories, when you all were talking about the Unchained Memories.
Unchained.
Yeah, you know, they had the DVD, you know, and the book as well. That was back in about the 1920s and the 30s, and that was over 100,000 former slaves that they ended up talking to.
That's what I said, 100,000.
Yeah. I didn't hear that the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Wow,
yeah.
I didn't know that many people.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, indeed. It was over 100,000. And then they also have some movies as well, you know, where it was funny you had missed. Didn't you mention Ruby? I know you mentioned Ruby D, but I didn't know if you said something about Roscoe Lee Brown. But he was also in the movies, in that narrative that they had, because in the late 1930s, it was estimated 100,000 former slaves that were still alive in the U.S. and in the midst of the Great Depression from 1936 to 38, where there were more than over 2,000 interviews were done with one-time slaves, and it was conducted for the Work Projects Administration's via the Federal Writers Project, with the transcripts written in, you know, vernacular terms. And, you know, they were getting firsthand accounts of what slave life was really like. But Detroit does have a great deal of history. And I would like to say, Bishop, I would love to have both you and the doctor on my show as well, because you two seem to be very well versed. And I can tell, Bishop, your eyes have seen a lot of things in your time.
Wow. I would have to concur that that history is kind of, you know, when I started out on this journey of life, my intent was to be something and somebody completely different,
mm-hmm.
but God has God's way of putting you where you're supposed to be. because when I was in college, I never would have thought that I'd end up living in Detroit. That was not my plan. And I feel so blessed that I have been able to encounter, and just to have, like I was talking about being around Rosa Parks and various other people, just to be have been able to be in their energy, you know, to be able to speak to them. I think that that's such a blessing, you know, just to say, I've encountered these people and they touch me in a particular way. You know, I think that that's a tremendous blessing. And that's one of the reasons why we exist and why we do what we do, because not only was I able to encounter these people, so were the folk who come to the Culture Center and come to our events and meet with folks so that we can bring those people to the people who they speak to.
Exactly.
You know, that's...
We're down to our last few minutes.
We are? Wow.
I told you we were going to have a good time. We have 4 minutes. And I want to make sure that our listeners know, I want you to recap as to who you are, about the shrine, and just make sure they have all your information before we close out. Can you do that for me?
Sure. I'll do it very quickly.
Once again, 3 minutes.
I'm in Kenjay IB, and I am the manager, the artist in residence, and a whole bunch of other stuff at the Shrine of the Black Madonna Cultural Center and Bookstore in Detroit. Our address in Detroit is 13535 Livernois Avenue. We're right near Davison. Our telephone number, in the event that you want to call us, is 313-491-0777. Our website is www.shrinebookstore.com. And if you want to, you know, contact us, reach out to us, go on our website. We're going to be adding other kinds of things to the site. We have plans to do some additional kinds of things to reach out to our community. We want to be an education station for our community. That's important, particularly since so many of our schools are having problems in the city. You know, that we need to be able to help parents educate their children where they need to.
What about your wedding services?
If you're interested in getting information about a cultural wedding ceremony, or how to acquire the things that you need for weddings, or if you need to be in contact with somebody who can do your cakes, your rings, and all those things, I can definitely work with you on that from start to finish. You know, whatever you're looking for, we try to focus on cultural weddings. When I say cultural, I'm talking about more African-inspired nuptials.
And can you also mention the other cultural areas around
in the city of Detroit, or
right, you know, places that you recommend besides?
I would suggest anybody coming to Detroit, please do not leave Detroit without visiting the Museum of African American History, the Charles H. Wright Museum, named for Dr. Charles H. Wright, who founded it. It is the largest museum of its kind in the United States that was created and shaped by us. The largest black museum in the country. It is absolutely beautiful. They have a wonderful core exhibit. Once they've updated it, it's really great, and they always have traveling exhibits as well. So I think that if you come to Detroit, you got to go there. When you come to Detroit, you should definitely go to make arrangements to go on the Underground Railroad tour at First Congregational Church. Just contact us, and we'll try to fill you in on all the places that you can go.
You could keep talking.
Oh, it's in 90 seconds. The African World Festival is coming up in August, and for those who are going to be in the Detroit area, it's the third weekend in August, all 3 days. I think it's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. It's a wonderful experience. You'll be able to meet all kinds of vendors and get things that may not be able to acquire in other venues, but we're all about trying to reach out to our community.
And what about Motown?
The Motown Museum, I don't know what their hours are. It's Hicksville, USA. Right now it's probably about a few hundred people standing out in front of it, giving their tribute to Michael Jackson. And this weekend actually is the 50th anniversary of Motown. And it's just just uncanny that Michael would pass at the 50th anniversary of Motown during that period of time. So there's all kind of people there. But I think that's an important milestone in our history in terms of music, that we, you know, had institutions that we published the music ourselves and packaged the artists. You know, no matter how you might feel or not feel about Barry Gordy, I think that Motown is something that's important.
Okay, and your phone number one more time?
313-491-0777. And it's been great talking with both you gentlemen as well as our host.
Leslie.
Leslie, I look forward to having future conversations with you all.
Well, the feelings are indeed mutual.
The show has stopped streaming, but we're still recording, so our internet listeners can't hear. But if you want to talk to Jerry Butler and Dr. Metters, we can talk, you know, the show. Unfortunately, our audience can't hear it live, but it is being recorded, and we are enjoying your conversation. And if you have a few more minutes, I know Dr. Metters was eager to finish what he had to say or ask you. Do you have a few minutes?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Okay. The only question I have, I can probably tie it anyway. But my when it comes to your interviews, that's just like an historian. They always go back to find out what's left, you know, long after we're gone. They'll be digging up something about you, you know, what you wrote, what you said. I just ask that because sometimes people are in a unique position to, you know, ask certain questions that, you know, you don't find in the literature or in the autobiography or the autobiographies. It's like Motown. I'm interested. I love Motown and Smokey Robinson and Dinah Ross and all the different stories. You know, sometimes people who were right there on the spot, they ask questions about this or that, and then they just, you know, leave it, you know, somewhere in their letters and everything like that. And when we go back and dig up your stuff, and they say, oh, she interviewed X person, and historians after you will draw on that and make that a part and parcel of their work. So that's why I put that out. You don't have to interview anybody. I would never press you to do it. But since you're in a strategical position to get so close to these, you know, people, you know, I say, wow, what do they say? And what's their position on this? And how do you feel about that? And, but, you know, like you said, you're just enjoying the moment, and I respect that.
Well, you know what, though? You've given me something to actually think about, because with the recent passing, for example, with Dr. Ivan Van Sertima, we were blessed on more than one occasion. We've had a long relationship with Dr. Yosef Ben Yochanan. Reverend Clegg and Dr. Ben were very close. In fact, he mentions Dr. Ben in his book, The Black Messiah. He and Bar Shango, who's also deceased now, I've had opportunities to meet, you know, and speak with Dr. Bar Shango when we would have Dr. Clark, because we used to have these people come and speak at the shrine. So Dr. John Henry Clark has spoken on several occasions. You know, what would happen would he'd be at the bookstore on Saturday, and then on Sunday evening he would speak at the shrine. And I was always impressed by how sharp he was, because, you know, Dr. Clark was blind before he, you know, passed away. He couldn't see. But he would get up there, and his mind was sharp as a tack. He would speak with no notes and just, bam, to send out this information. And he was pleasant to
our listeners. Dr. Henry Clark is, because, you know, a lot of people, youngsters and college students, will be able to upload or download this interview. And they may not know who Henry Clark is. Explain.
Dr. John Henry Clark.
Yes.
But also the same thing with Dr. Van Sertima. On many occasions, we asked when Dr. Van Sertima would come to speak at the shrine, he would stay in this building, in this very building where I'm sitting at right now, our residence hall and training center. We have guest apartments. So when Dr. Van Sertima and his former wife, when they would come here, I'd be the one making up the bed for the apartment for him to be able to, that they would stay in. Then they would speak at the shrine. They'd be at the bookstore. And so the brother that was doing the books on Marcus Garvey. Oh my goodness, why can't I think of his name? Tony Martin. Same thing. We've had all these different. I've had great opportunities. And time I spent talking with these people. And I never even thought about, okay, let me put this down on paper and say, okay, these were my experiences with these people. But that's what Dr. Metters.
Yeah.
You have really put something on my mind in terms of, you know, I'm going to look at my interaction with these people in a different way, and I might actually try to approach it from that perspective, because I hadn't done that before.
Right.
You know, because I don't even ask people to take pictures of me with them. What would happen would be customers would be there, and they would take pictures, and they would just give me one of the pictures. You know, and so I had a few I put to the side. And before my mother passed away, I wanted her, because she lived in a different city. So I wanted her to know what my life was like. Because sometimes when you leave home when you're young, your parents, they kind of know you're trying to do the right thing, but they don't understand exactly what you do. But so I took the pictures with me. And I talked with my mother, and I let her look at them. Because, you know, she's looking at a picture of Sinbad and like, oh, I know who that is, and I know who this person is. And, you know, that made me feel like she understood that I turned out okay.
Mm-hmm.
But what you've given to me in terms of this discussion has made me think about, okay, I can kind of start, you know, looking at how I, you know, go through these experiences and see what I can put down. I've had a whole bunch of times I've spent with Dr. Dyson, Michael Eric Dyson.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you all, did you all watch that Black in America program?
Yes.
Yeah.
Did you see the segment that he was in?
I didn't, but you're talking about the CNN special, right?
Yeah, the CNN special.
Right.
Because part of it was filmed at our cultural center with Dr. Dyson upstairs.
Right.
Oh.
You might even see a little glimpse of me sitting up there. But but CNN, because they were traveling with him, he was promoting his book on Dr. King, that 1963 book he had done. And so he was promoting that book, and so CNN was following him, and so they filmed that whole piece that he did with us. They filmed it all. I asked them for a copy, but of course they wouldn't give me a copy of our piece. But folk were looking at that, and a couple of our church members were looking at that, and they said, that kind of looks familiar. I said, it should. It's the cultural center. It's up in the art gallery. Because I've done so many, I've been with him on numbers of occasions. When he comes to Detroit, he used to be mentored by the late Dr. Frederick Sampson. And so when he would come to Detroit, when Dr. Sampson was still living, he would preach at Tabernacle. So he would call me up and say, can you come over to Tab with us in the morning, bring books, this and that and other. So we would spend hours together.
Okay.
You know? And so I never, you know, thought, okay, let me, you know, shape this. But I might go ahead and try to do that.
Yeah, because a lot of people listening don't know who these people are. And when you introduce these different guests that you entertained at the Cultural Center, you're exposing them to who Henry Clark is. Well, why are you fascinated by Dr. Henry Clark? You follow?
Mm-hmm.
So when you introduce them to your mother, let's say that's who your audience would be while you're writing this to your mom, you say, well, Mom, you don't know who this is. This is, and just like you explained to us, how this man was able to tell you everything about Africa.
And see, the impact, and I think that's the part that I might be able to plug into, at least in terms of helping people understand the impact that these people have had on our community.
And our culture.
And, you know, in general, that's what I'm saying, you know, our community, our culture, that these folks who, and many of them, we're losing them at an alarming rate. Dr. Ben is in a nursing home in New York, and he's not in good health now. And he's like one of the few that we have left. You know, Dr. Van Sertima passed on Memorial Day. And, you know, Jacob Carruthers is gone. So we don't have the wealth of historians that we once had. And our younger historians, many of them are not writing.
Well, you know, we had a show about the historians, didn't we, Dr. Metters and Jerry Butler?
Yes, indeed.
And we had Wade Hudson. He told me he was going to call in. Are you familiar with Just Us Books, Wade Hudson?
I'm familiar with Just Us Books, yes.
Okay, well, he said he was going to call in. He would love to publish your book on the historians that you met and entertained at your cultural center. And I don't know him that well, but I know him just from our conversations through the Blog Talk Radio show. And he's looking to promote stories about our culture and people who preserved it. And I'm pretty sure if you told him what you just told us, that you want to introduce and save these gentlemen's legacy by way of a book, I don't think he would have a problem with sitting down and meeting with you. Because I've never talked to anybody who put these historians on a pedestal the way you have. And not just that you put them on a pedestal, but you have touched them, physically touched them. And that's an insight that we don't have. And I think it should be shared because it's such an innocent insight. And you came to them with a spirit of wanting to learn. You know, so I think it's awesome that Dr. Metters, you know, brought that out of you during this conversation. I hope it happens. You know, that's my prayer. Anyone want to add anything to encourage Bishop Abbey to pursue?
I would like to just chime in and just simply say that I think that's part of your calling, Bishop. And you know what? I'm going to help make it come to fruition because I would love to have you on my show. And I see you got an excellent talk game. Your personality is just so magnetic. You're such a great listener, and you're so well-versed. And you will be able to use our shows, our blog talk radio shows, as your forum. And I'm extending the opportunity to you right now to not only you and the doctor to be a guest on my show, but also to bring your world of people right to the forefront. And you can sit right there, even if you don't want to be the person to do the interviewing. You just chime in, girl, and remember that time. And here we go.
You should have a blog talk radio show of your own at the Shrine. Let me tell you how I found out about you. I found out about you through an Ohio bookseller at the Antiquarium New York book show. And I asked a lady, a Caucasian woman, to be a part of the show. And she gave me your information. She said, call these people. They deal with a lot of black artifacts. And she said that you also have a lot of black celebrities that come through your door that collect. Is that true?
I don't know about a lot of celebrities that collect. We've had celebrities, not, you know, in Atlanta, they have more of that than we do.
Okay.
Like people like Jeanetta Cole. I don't know if you know her or not.
Mm-hmm.
She's President Spelman. She's a big collector. She's in Atlanta a lot. I think our Atlanta store comes in contact with, like, Judith Jameson always goes to Atlanta. You know who Judith Jameson is?
Yes,
yeah.
She's a dancer,
oh,
right?
Right, that took over Alvin Ailey's company after he passed away.
Yeah.
Okay, but those, they tend to, now we've had, like, who had us since, we've had a few people that, like, Victoria Rowell, of course, Elin Harris, different people who've come through and then they've seen something that they like. And eventually have us ship it to them or something like that. But we don't get a lot of celebrities that come in as collectors. Atlanta seems to get more of that than we do because Atlanta is like the black mecca these days.
Yeah.
Well, you know, a lot of black, you know, black entertainers and stuff have moved to Atlanta.
That's right.
They ain't moved to Detroit.
Oh.
They moved to Atlanta. So Atlanta tends to get more of that. We have, like what she has said, we've had the lady you were speaking with, we have had a lot of black celebrities in the cultural center, but they're not necessarily collectors of artifacts. You know, like people when Gladys Knight was there, Monique from the Monique Show.
Right.
She's been there. You know, but these are people that we've had that have come on book tour, on lecture to talk, and usually they don't do a lot of buying
when they
come for that.
That's sad. I didn't want to hear that.
Well, I'm saying all that to say these. When you're on book tour, you might be at 2-3 at Elin Harris. He might be at 4-5 stores in the course of one day trying to fulfill the responsibilities of his book tour.
Right.
And they're traveling from, you know, they might even sleep in the city that they're in. I can just definitely, I just recently had Hill Harper at the bookstore. You know Hill Harper that's on CSI New York?
Yes.
Okay.
Is he Republican or something?
No, he's tight ace bone buddies with President Obama.
Oh,
they were
okay.
Classmates at Harvard.
Right, right. Okay.
Oh no, he no Republican girl.
Okay, I got that the brother, wrong that, one. I'm sorry, I was asking.
Okay, that brother has got his head on very straight.
Okay.
But when he was with us the previous time, and I think this last time too, they have to go to the stores they're going to be at, and then they leave and get on a plane and go to their next city. They don't even necessarily spend the night in the city that they're in. So they can't, like, tote a bunch of stuff along with them. You know, if somebody really, and they don't even have time. They hit our door as soon as they left their other book signing or they're rushing in. Then they got to do their event. Then they got to rush back out to go to their next event. So I understand it. You know, it's not like they don't. And we have had some that will shop with us if they've got the time, and then they have to have somebody ship the stuff back home because you can't get on a plane. If you buy something at every place you go, you're going to have a hard time if you're traveling for several weeks doing a book tour. So I don't fault them for that. What I do, and this is just between us since we're not on the air.
But we are recording.
Okay, it's all right. It can be recorded.
Okay.
I would like for our African American authors, for lack of a better term, and I'm not going to get in such a while talking about African American, but I would prefer that our authors at least take the opportunity when it's there to do their events at black owned bookstores. The publishing companies do not have that same care about putting the authors, black authors, in black stores. They prefer to try to put them in border stores. Now, we've had debates because, we've been in business for 39 years, and it's because of efforts of our store and others like us that there's an industry that's built up around black authors. You know, white folks just didn't decide today, oh, we're going to publish black people. When they saw that there were some successes that these authors were having, they said, okay, we need to be in on this. We need to be making this money. And they began to publish more black authors because they saw that there was money to be made. But the industry, the people that would come out, they were coming to black stores. So now once the author becomes well-known, what happens is, they, you know, don't put them in the black stores. They put them in the Borders and the Barnes and Nobles. And the stores like Borders and Barnes and Noble, we can't tell anybody what they can sell and what they can't sell. But they only have those books for that event. And they, as soon as that event is over, I remember one author told us they could hear the tape gun zipping across the top of the box before they could get out the store because they knew they were going to send those books right back to the publishing company.
That's sad.
I've heard them say this. I'm not making it up. I heard them say this. So they know that the only reason why they're there is because these stores want to make money. I've had some serious disagreements with some of the people that are over the publicity departments, like at Random House, Christian Waters. You know, I asked him, I said, well, what's the problem? Why can't we get this person or that person in our store? And they said, well, you know, we are trying to diversify their readership. And I said, you know, that's not true. I said, what you doing? I said, because most of the time, you don't get crossover. Most white people don't read black fiction authors. They just don't. You know, like we don't necessarily read John Gresham. We'd be more inclined to read John Gresham than they would be inclined to read Terry McMillan. But you're trying to diversify the customer base of those stores. You're trying to get the black customers into those stores. I know what you're trying to do, so don't tell me something else. So we would go back and forth all the time. And somebody that's a great person for trying to deal with that problem is Walter Mosley. Walter Mosley, what he will do, every other book, he tries to have it published by a black publisher. Even though he doesn't get the same kind of inducements as the major publishers can offer, it helps try to keep some black publishers afloat.
That's nice of him.
You know, but he's a conscientious man. You know, he's a really good brother. I was at the 35th anniversary for Hakeem Mahbouti's publishing company for Third World Press. That's the press that actually did Tavis Smiley's the one that he had that was a million seller. Was a Contract for America. I wish I could think of the name of it. But anyway, at Third World Press, at their anniversary, Walter Mosley came to celebrate with them. And Hakeem got up and said, you know who Hakeem Mahbouti is, right? He used to be Don Lee.
No, not familiar with him at all.
Out of Chicago, Third World Press. Okay. We're going to work on that. Cause he's an important person to just in terms of authors and educating and all that. Hakeem Mahbouti. We'll get to him. But anyway, we were at Third World Press's 35th anniversary, and Walter was there, and Haki got up and talked about how Walter had given him a call, and they were just chit-chatting and everything. And so he mentioned to Walter he was having some distress because, you know, his roof in his school, because he has a couple of schools in Chicago. He's had them since the early 70s. His roof was leaking in the school, and he had to close the school. So Walter said, well, what you need? He said, well, I'm just trying to put together some money to get the roof fixed. So Walter said, well, I just got a royalty check for $12,000. I'll send that to you. And he just sent him the check.
Wow.
For $12,000 so he could work on getting his roof fixed. He didn't say, can you pay me back or not? He just gave him the money. But that's the kind of man that Walter Mosley is. But most people don't know that about him.
Yeah, see, those are the stories that you have to write to your mom and publish it for everybody to read.
I really like Walter, and I've got some pictures of him, too. You know, just, I mean, I really like him as a person. You know, just when you get a chance to actually talk to folks, and, you know, you're trying to help them, you know, you take their coat, you tell they're trying to go to the restroom, you're trying to feed them, you know, different things because, you know, they're on a tight schedule. You try to, that's our goal anyway, is to try to do as much to make them comfortable as possible. Because trust me, if you got to go this place, in a short amount of time, you don't have half a chance to eat anything. And most of the stores, they just want to sit you down there and help you sell some of their books. And we don't, you know, we want to have an experience with our authors when they come. You know, Gladys Knight, this is my last story, and then I'm going to get done. When Gladys Knight came, when she wrote her biography, she was supposed to get to the bookstore, I think was supposed to start at 5. Well, people started coming about 3 o'clock, and it was all over the store and lined up. And Miss Knight was running late because she was on the radio doing an interview, and so she got to the bookstore late, and then they had to tape a television segment with her before we let everybody go upstairs for the book signing. So Gladys came in, and they went upstairs, and I told everybody, okay, we got to wait a little bit longer because, you know, they got to finish this TV thing upstairs first. So when they finished, the television crew came down, and we let everybody go upstairs for the book signing, and I had it all organized because I don't like people rushing up on the author. So before she got up to speak, I had to get up and tell everybody that they couldn't take any pictures because that's what the publishing company told us. No photographs, you know. All she can sign are books, no photographs and all this stuff. So Gladys said, who said that? She said, it was some publishing people, wasn't it? And I said, yes. Gladys Knight stood up and she just posted it, cheese, so people could take a bunch of pictures of her, right?
That's good.
So she sat down, and she was always supposed to have been in the store from 5 until 7. Gladys Knight ended up leaving that store about 10 o'clock that night. She stayed until the last book was signed and the last hand was shook.
Wow.
She was so gracious. Her daughter had a cake business, these pound cakes. And so they were selling the cakes, and she asked me, could we have an extra table so they could give out some samples of the cakes so people would buy them. She had a Patti LaBelle cake, a Gladys Knight cake. It was several different flavors of pound cakes. So we said, sure. You know, we set up an extra table, and they sold out of the pound cakes. So all the people who wanted the cakes, Gladys asked me, could if it's possible, the people were going to pay for the cakes in advance. They were going to have the cakes shipped to us overnight, and then the people could come and pick up their cake the next day. And we said, okay, so we worked it out. The cakes arrived from Federal Express. We put them downstairs in the refrigerator, and then as people came in, because we had the list, her daughter had written it with the people's names who were supposed to pick up what cake. And so they came and picked up their cakes. They had prepaid for them. And it's just that kind of experience.
Yeah.
You know, and she was so gracious. You know, she was so open and honest about her life and her gambling problems and different things like that you don't necessarily see when somebody's sitting on television or, you know, you hear them singing on the stage. But it was just, you know, she was just great.
I learned a whole lot about you by the people that you admire. That says a lot about who you are. I enjoyed myself. Dr. Metters, do you have any parting words?
No, I enjoyed myself. She's a natural storyteller. Very articulate.
Yes, she is.
I think very voluble. In other words, her words just roll off her mouth like a melody. Melodious.
Well, please get in contact with Jerry Butler. He has a phenomenal show. He has a listenership which is 100 times larger than my listenership. And our goal is to make sure that these stories that you're telling and your bookstore, your institution, that it doesn't leave without being noticed and that we share it. And so as many people that I could tell about what you're doing and who you are, I'm going to tell them. And the best way to do it starting today is through Mr. Butler. Okay?
Okay. All right. So now, unfortunately, where I am positioned, I don't have any writing implements.
No, that's right. I get all your information, and I got the Shrines. What is it? The Shrine of Black Madonna, 313-491-0777.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And
let me give you my. Can I give you my email address?
Sure, you can do that too.
Okay, my email address is Shrine.
S H R I N E.
I N E Center, and that's okay. The American spelling C E N T E R.
Uh huh.
One, that's the number one,
uh-huh.
At AOL.com.
I'm on AOL also. I'll be able to instant message you. Okay, I got you. And anything else I need, I get from the host, believe me, because it's been a pleasure. And you are a very, just like somebody read a good book, you are a very interesting read.
Oh, my Lord. But thank you. I'm just stunned by that. Thanks. It's been really great talking
and,
to you.
And Dr. I don't want to leave you out either. I'm coming after you too, cause
I'm not going nowhere. I'll just sit down here, and when the tears roll down my face, and everybody gets in front of me, I'm still right there looking at you.
All right, I got you, my brother.
Get my hand.
And Leslie, I want to thank you so much for inviting me in once again. It's my pleasure to always chime in and support you and your wonderful, very talented, well-versed guests any way that I possibly can.
Well, thanks, Mr. Butler. We'll talk later on.
Yes, we will.
Dr. Metters, I'll give you a call. And again, Bishop Abi, it's been a true experience. I knew that you wouldn't let me down. And you were wide open, and you just got to hear a lot about you and what you're doing in Detroit. And I know I'm headed down there. Aren't you guys?
Well, you know I'm in Virginia. And going to be
on
the road.
Where are you in Virginia?
In Virginia Beach, in the Hampton Roads area. When you coming through? You coming through here soon?
No, my brother is in Norfolk.
Come on now, he's 20 minutes away from me.
Really?
That's how close Hampton and Norfolk. That's all considered the Hampton Roads area.
Oh my goodness.
That's right. When he called you, he called you at 7572. His area code is 757. That's right.
He just called me last night.
Okay.
Norfolk.
Mm. All right.
He was a Navy man.
That's right. I got you. You got more stories than the Highway Patrol. I'm going to definitely be in touch with you.
Okay.
Okay, well, we're all going to say bye-bye. It's hard to say bye when we have a great guest, but we have to do it. And I'll give you a call, Bishop Abi. Thank you again for this interview.
All right.
And likewise to you,
Well, fellas. Thank you for having me.
Oh.
And I've been very happy to have met all of you all.
The feelings are indeed mutual, young lady.
Y'all take care.
Okay,
you too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.